Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And yes, tonight we start with a kind of apology and explanation. The podcasts haven't been coming out at the normal rate of at least one, sometimes two or more a week. It looks like I have, in fact, actually been struck down with a mild version of the coronavirus early in the year. I wondered what that rather unpleasant flu-like occurrence was. And I've been suffering from a long period of post-viral exhaustion, so some weeks I'm kind of taking several afternoons just to rest and to sleep. Apologies. I know there are lots of people that enjoy the podcast, and we will get back to normal, but I have to take it slightly easier than I normally do. That said, we're going to look tonight at a really interesting topic area. As you have probably picked up in this podcast before, I greatly enjoy the work of Sheila Fitzpatrick, and we've been looking at everyday Stalinism and looking at the nuances of private life and public life in the Soviet Union. And one of the ways of looking at everyday life is obviously through the prism of families. We've looked at what life was like within Soviet families and the difficulties of poor housing and shortages and that kind of thing. But tonight we're going to look at children. And, you know, it is a truism that the way a society treats its children tells you an awful lot. And the combined effects of an already struggling and backward society prior to the revolution, a catastrophic civil war and famine just following the revolution, and then a prolonged period of economic hardship following the decision to pursue forced industrialisation at the end of the 1920s and into the 1930s presents all sorts of opportunities for children to be neglected, to be forgotten, to be abandoned. And here we're going to look at how the Soviet state responded to the challenge of the abandoned child. And Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "The upbringing of children is normally considered women's business, and so it was in Soviet Russia in the 1930s. It was women, not men, who wrote again and again to the authorities asking for help for their children. Barefoot and hungry. It was women who occasionally despaired and wrote to the authorities begging them to have their children taken into state care or adopted as mascots by army regiments. It was a woman who, on hearing her younger child cry for bread after 2 weeks of hunger in the winter of 1936-37, got up and went down into the kitchen and ended her life. It was even a woman, a widowed Kolkhoz chairman and two young children, who cabled the regional party secretary that if bread was not sent, she would be obliged to abandon the children and the Kolkhoz and run away. The pressures on particularly women, and particularly women, peasant women of poorer backgrounds, was immense. They had not only a traditional patriarchal expectation upon them to provide care for their children, but following a brief period of liberation in terms of gender roles shortly after the revolution, a social conservatism descended back on Russia during the Stalin era, and any chance that women might be liberated from their traditional gender roles was dismissed. If women were, of course, the main providers of childcare, then it would be logical that they're also the ones who would be held primarily responsible by the state for any neglect that occurred. This was the case sometimes, though it was more common to find that it was stepmothers who were charged with cruelty and neglect than natural mothers. There were some cases where men incurred blame, or more of the blame than women, though that was rare. But overall, the scope of the problem of child neglect and child abandonment in Russia during the 1930s was immense. Because, of course, you have an immensely mobile society. You have a geographically mobile. You have peasants encouraged to work in towns and cities. You have families torn apart by the state, and children of dubious class origins left without parents or perhaps even criminalised themselves. And you have mass mobilisation of families, sometimes entire communities, sent into exile. And there is, of course, another huge problem, and it's a housing problem, that in Russia there are families who are forced, not out of sheer desperation, to split their children up and send them to other relatives because there isn't enough room for them in the cramped housing that is on offer. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, housing was a key factor in one of the more vexing cases of child neglect and abuse encountered by party leaders and judicial authorities. Rosa Vasilieva was a 14-year-old Moscow schoolgirl in 1936 when she wrote an earnest letter to Stalin suggesting a child tax to be paid by all Soviet citizens from the state, from which the state would pay each child a stipend from birth to the age of 18. This was to protect children from possible neglect and abuse by their parents. Although Rosa's letter was couched in abstract terms and contained no direct personal appeal, she did indicate that she had first-hand knowledge of problems associated with divorced parents and contested living space. Perhaps this was what caught the eye of Stalin's assistant, Poskrebyshev, and prompted him to forward the letter to Andrei Vyshinsky, a legal expert who was deputy head of the Council of People's Commissars. Vyshinsky, for context, was the judge at the show trials of Zinoviev, Kamenev, Bukharin, and others, and who violently berated them from his position. Vyshinsky had the Moscow City Prosecutor's Office investigate Rosa's situation, and a sad story emerged. Like so many sad Soviet stories, it revolved around housing. Rosa and her parents had once lived together in a room of 11 square metres. Then the parents got divorced, and Rosa stayed on in the room with her father, Alexander Vasilyev. When his job took him outside Moscow, he found a woman, Vronskaya, to look after Rosa on a live-in basis, but the militia would not register Vronskaya as a separate occupant because the room was too small. So, as he later explained, he was forced to marry her to get her registered. The prosecutor's office put almost all the blame for Rosa's subsequent sufferings on Vronskaya. "A hysterical personality," they wrote, "who in her father's absence abused Rosa, interrupted her homework, refused to allow her to have a bed, and finally, 1 month after obtaining her own registration as a resident, tried to throw her out on the street. A battle royale of competing eviction orders then ensued between Vronskaya, Rosa's father, and Rosa's mother. The orders were all ignored, and after 3 years of effort, when Rosa was in her last year of high school or already graduated, Vyshinsky finally gave up on the case." What seems interesting in this story is that the three adults, Rosa's father, Rosa's mother, and the then stepmother Vronskaya, all issued competing eviction orders trying to evict one of the three individuals, Rosa, Vronskaya, and her father, from the flat, all seemingly cancelling one another out and creating a kind of illegal chaos. And legal chaoses are only really possible because of what it is the law says. And there must have been all manner of chaos within the Soviet laws regarding residencies, flats, and evictions. And in the middle, the child, Rosa, is the one that suffers. And so there is quite a degree of culpability of the state here in creating the circumstances whereby duplicitous relatives or step-parents could apply for evictions of children, of stepchildren, and the state appears to have very little ability to do much about it. The most famous of all child neglect cases in the mid-1930s was the Gaeta case, publicised in the Labour newspaper Trud, and the subject of a show trial in a large Moscow factory. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "This was a case of problems associated with divorce and remarriage rather than housing. Gaeta Kashtanova was born in Bezhitsa in 1930 to Kashtanov, a technician, and Vasilieva, a worker. They had met and married in 1929 at the Red Profintern plant. Around the time of Gaeta's birth, Kashtanov left. Vasilieva tried to trace him to get child support payments, but was unsuccessful. Not wanting or able to bring up the child herself, she handed her over to her mother. After a time, Vasilieva married again, a communist named Smolyakov, who had a good job in the trade unions, and they had 2 children.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Then the grandmother became ill and sent Geta, aged 5, back to her mother. The Smolyakovs had moved to Kaluga, where Smolyakov was the editor of a newspaper. He was well paid, and they kept a servant, Malusia, in their 3-room apartment, which was spacious by Soviet standards for a household of 6. But Vasilieva did not want Geta, whom she evidently disliked, and started to beat her. Smolyakov did not join in, but neither did he interfere to protect the child. Somehow, at this point, Vasilieva learned the address of her former husband, Kashtanov, now an engineer living in Moscow. She decided to solve the problem by sending the child to live with her father. Accordingly, the servant Marusia took Geta up to Moscow to Kashtanov's address. But Kashtanov refused to take it, saying that his apartment was too small and he did not earn enough to support himself and the child. The child's return provoked a new outburst of rage from Vasilieva, and she once again started to beat Geta. Then she ordered Marusia to take Geta to Kashtanov's a second time and abandon her on the street if he refused to take her in. She told Geta, "Auntie Marusia is going to leave you. Don't cling to her. If you come back, I will kill you." The urgency of Vasilieva's desire to get rid of the child was evidently related to the fact that Smolyakov had gone to a new job in Milerovo, much further from Moscow, and she was about to follow him, minus Geta. On the evening of January the 21st, 1935, Marusia and Geta turned up again on Kashtanov's doorstep. Again, Kashtanov refused to take her, though he did escort the two to a bus stop and give them a ruble for the fare. This was presumably not a happy position for Marusia either, since as a result of Vasilieva's departure for Milerovo, she was unemployed as well, as a burden with responsibility for Geta. So Marusia followed Vasilieva's orders, taking Geta to a toy shop, and then, according to one account, vanishing into the crowd. According to another account, Geta was left knowingly and did not object because her mother had told her the nanny that if Geta came back, she would suffocate or poison her. 4 days later, Geta was brought into the 22nd precinct of the Moscow militia, dirty and ragged. The girl said she had no passport, it writes in official reports. Her mummy lived in Bezhitsa, and that she didn't know anything about her daddy and that she was hungry. A penciled note found on her read, "Geta Kashtanova, 5 years old. Father is an engineer living in the 11th lane of Marina Roshcha, number 30, apartment 2. He drove the girl out to the street. Have pity on her, good people." Following the script established by this note, the militiamen tried to persuade Kashtanov to take the child. Kashtanov continued to refuse, and a highly coloured report in Trude tagged him as the villain of the piece. "Let engineer Kashtanov be brought to justice." On the same day, the district prosecutor announced that he was bringing charges against Kashtanov under the Article 158 of the Criminal Code, and Kashtanov was arrested. So the investigation proceeded, and the attention eventually switched to Vasilieva, as you might expect. On the evidence, she was arrested on May the 6th. And by the time the case came to court, she'd become the main defendant, with Kashtanov and Marusia also charged with neglect and abuse, but to a lesser extent. The trial was then held as a show trial in the club of the Trigonia textile plant in July, where a woman prosecutor and an audience consisting largely of women workers from the plant brought a huge amount of public attention to what was occurring. She was originally, the prosecutors originally demanded a 3-year sentence for Vasilieva, but she managed to get away without a prison sentence at all. Her ex-husband, got 6 months in prison and was ordered to pay 125 rubles a month, which was over a third of his salary, to Geta's grandmother. who once again acted as her guardian. After the sentence was pronounced, the audience of women remained in the hall, and a unanimous cry of "too little" was heard. The prosecutor then took to the floor again and said she would petition for a more severe law for people who do not pay child support, meaning, of course, men. And that was this seems to be the key point that the audience was most angry about. It wasn't so much about child abandonment as about refusals to pay for child support. And here we see a very interesting snapshot of the tensions and often resentments that existed within Soviet family life, and the general view of many women that the errant husband, the no good, unreliable husband, was always the kind of the villain of the piece. The reaction to the case, as Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, the reaction to the Gator case suggests that women's resentment against men's refusal to recognise the family responsibilities ran deep. This was presumably recognised by the authorities, as witnessed by the decision to hold a show trial with a female prosecutor before an audience of female workers. Around the same time as the Gator case, a much less serious propaganda event with a somewhat similar message was held in a Leningrad publishing house. In this case, no child abuse had occurred, and the family in the spotlight was clearly prosperous, even enlightened. The event consisted of a report by a communist, Comrade Zharinov, an official at the publishing house, on how he brings up his children. The report focused on his inadequacies. "I must confess," said Zharinov, "that up to this time, I paid very little attention to the upbringing of my children. I became particularly aware, acutely aware of this now, when I am telling the comrades about my life as a communist father. In our family, up to this time, the arrangement was that my wife alone concerned herself with the upbringing of the children, and I had almost nothing to do with it." And here what we're seeing is a kind of like a self-criticism session, which was commonplace in Stalinist Russia. The audience began to question. They asked, "Is your daughter a pioneer? Does the child see people drunk in the family? Do the parents use bad language in front of the children? Does the child have its separate dishes to eat from? With whom do your children socialise? Who are their closest friends? What grades did the children receive in school for the second quarter?" And so on. Zharinov was unable to answer any of these questions. He did not know how his children were doing in school or what they did in their free time. As a result, he was sharply criticised by the audience for bringing up his children badly. The strange thing about the story is that Zharinov's wife, present at the meeting with their daughter Lida, was not criticised at all, and was barely mentioned in the discussion at all. So this could imply that possibly she had been part of the kind of this much less extreme form of neglect, but a kind of perhaps a sort of an emotional neglect. But perhaps a more plausible reading was that the intended message of this meeting was that it was men, not women, who were inclined to neglect their children and should change their ways. Zharinov's wife's moment and his daughter Lida's presumably came at the happy end of the meeting when Comrade Zharinov, it says, and his family enlisted in the competition for the best upbringing of children. So there were these kinds of pressures on Soviet families. Many of the decisions taken that you heard about here were based as a result of economic crisis. They're remarkably similar to the sorts of stories one would hear in Victorian England. of people having to abandon children or send them away due to overcrowding or hunger. And the thing we'll look at next, and there isn't time for it right now, but we'll move on to next, are the actual homeless children, the orphaned children, and the street gangs that emerged as a result of the Russian Civil War and the poverty of the Stalin era. One thing that always kind of stands out when you read Sheila Fitzpatrick is that the official vision of a well-ordered, you know, an authoritarian, brutal, but ultimately disciplined and well-ordered society that you one gets from a kind of more simple version of Soviet history is really not there. That you have a bureaucratic and sometimes often quite weak state in a way that seems to be very challenged when attempting to control, to shape and to develop in whatever way it sees fit, and quite an anarchic society, a society riven with trauma that faces often impossible economic dilemmas, and that has a kind of a deep sense of lawlessness and a view of law and authority that it is an almighty inconvenience that must be avoided, circumvented, and circumnavigated at all costs. This is the kind of the essence of Sheila Fitzpatrick's writing. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there, but thanks so much for listening, everybody. And like I said, you know, we'll be back to full steam at some point in the not-too-distant future. But I hope wherever you are, you're safe and well, and all is good. And I'll catch you all soon. Take good care now. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.